Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cellular Healing TV. I'm your host, Meredith Dykstra, and this is episode number 198. We have our resident cellular healing specialist, Dr. Dan Pompa, on the line. And today we welcome very special guest, Dr. Stephen Gundry. And we have a very interesting topic for you guys today, one that we haven't dug into on Cellular Healing TV yet. And this is the topic on lectins. And Dr. Gundry wrote a book called The Plant Paradox, which we're gonna dig into in a minute here, that explains all about what lectins are and how they might be affecting our cellular health. So before we dig in, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Gundry. Dr. Stephen Gundry is a renowned cardiologist, New York Times bestselling author, and medical researcher. During his 40-year career in medicine, he's performed over 10,000 heart surgeries and developed life-saving medical technology. In 2008, his book, Dr. Gundry's Diet Evolution, revealed a new career shift, helping patients to heal themselves and avoid surgery through diet. In April, his second book, The Plant Paradox, which we have right here, it's amazing, published by Harper's Wave, hit bookstores and is now a New York Times bestseller. His latest book outlines a 90-day plan for some of the world's most pressing health issues, from obesity to heart disease. Gundry MD, founded by Dr. Gundry in 2016, is a wellness blog, YouTube channel, and supplement company to further equip people with powerful tools in reclaiming their health. He practices medicine at his Weightless Clinics, a Center for Restorative Medicine, and International Heart and Lung Institute in Palm Springs and Santa Barbara, California. You can learn more at drgundry.com and gundrymd.com. Welcome, Dr. Gundry, to Cellular Healing TV. We're so excited to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, you know, I think that most people, you said, Meredith, that most people don't know what lectins are. We're going to get into that. But yes, they do, because the most famous one of all is gluten. So, right, everybody knows gluten, at least our viewers and listeners, you know, and the concerns about gluten. But, you know, years ago in many of my articles, I talked about lectins and phytates. And I'm sure no one knew what they were. But I said, well, look, there's other dangers beyond gluten as well, especially with those with compromised digestion. So lectins, let's get into them. You know, this is obviously a category that, you know, encompasses gluten, these proteins that potential poisons. Tell our viewers about them.
Yeah, so I got interested in lectins actually years ago with a couple of people who had obvious autoimmune diseases. And when my first book came out almost 10 years ago now, a lot of people with autoimmune diseases came in and said, gee, you know, my autoimmune disease is getting a whole lot better eating the way, you know, you describe in your first book, and what's going on? And I could have been flippant and said, well, this is a very anti-inflammatory diet, and that's why you're getting better. But I said, you know, I wonder what it is that I'm taking away from people. I had a no list and a yes list of foods that was really making the difference. And as I started looking at this, one of the big categories that was very clear that I was removing from people's diets were plants that contain lectins. Now, lectins are part of the plant defense system. They're actually a major part of the plant defense system. And what I try to convince people to realize is that plants do not like us. They were actually here first. They had it really good before animals arrived because nobody wanted to eat them. When animals arrived, they couldn't run, they couldn't hide, they couldn't fight, but they're chemists of incredible ability. Dan, you can look outside your window and see what plants can do with sunlight. And we haven't figured out how to do that. They can actually make matter. So they use proteins that are called lectins that are sometimes called sticky proteins. And they like to bind to specific sugar molecules. And we know what those sugar molecules are. The molecules that line our gut, excuse me, are loaded with sugar molecules like sialic acid. There are sugar molecules between nerve endings. And this was actually the original target of plants to paralyze insects, which was their original predator. And if you could paralyze an insect, that was a pretty good deterrent against being eaten. So plants use these proteins, and these proteins are actually very good at prying open the tight junctions between the wall of our intestinal lining. And surprisingly enough, you know, but most people don't realize that the lining of our intestine is only one cell thick, and its surface area is the same as a regulation tennis court, all bound up inside of us. And those poor cells are all lined up side by side, and they're held together like when I was a kid, we played a game called Red Rover, Red Rover, where we all locked arms in two rows and you ran across and tried to break through.
I did that.
In fact, you know, it's funny, as I lecture around the world, that there is the equivalent game in every culture I've found, obviously different names. But actually, as an aside, the young kids don't play it anymore. They're too busy on their computer instead of knocking people down. So what happens is, we know Dr. Fasano's work showed that gluten, which you mentioned, is a lectin, and other lectins are quite capable of attaching to the wall of our intestine and flipping a switch so that those tight junctions break. And when they break, two things happen. Number one, lectins, which are foreign proteins, get through the wall of our gut. But also, what I talk about in the book, there are pieces of bacteria, they're dead cell walls of bacteria, which are called lipopolysaccharides. I call them a little something different in the book, but they're LPSs. You could say little pieces of poop, but I use a little bit more stronger vernacular, even though I don't swear. So these two things, lectins and then these particles of bacteria, make our immune system absolutely go crazy. And one of the fascinating things is that our immune system goes around our body and looks for things that look like these proteins that are loose. And Lauren Cordain used the expression molecular mimicry years ago. And I like that, because that's exactly what I see in my practice. These lectins are cleverly designed to look like other proteins in our body. They are very similar to proteins that line the blood vessel, for instance. And when our immune system is turned on, the immune system doesn't want a mistake. And it goes, you know, that protein looks really similar to a protein I'm worried about. I think I'm going to kill this. I'm going to shoot it. And I'll ask questions later. And so we talk about, for instance, autoimmune disease as a mistake of our immune system in attacking ourselves. But in fact, it's an immune system that's been activated to look for lectins.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a good start.
So, okay. I mean, I'm going to ask the obvious, I think, what my viewers would be asking. Oh, my gosh. Okay. I'm already concerned. What foods am I getting exposed to these lectins in?
So I was being interviewed by a reporter actually yesterday. And I've made a statement that sometimes gets me attacked by my critics, that I'm now convinced that almost every illness is one way or another connected to a leaky gut and to lectins. And if you'd asked me that 15 years ago, I would have laughed you out of the room. But the more I see tens of thousands of patients, and I do pretty interesting, sophisticated blood work on them. And I can see when we remove lectins from their diet that their inflammation markers return to normal, that their autoimmune disease markers become normal. So where are these lectins? I like to look at this from a period of time when things appeared in our food supply. And up until 10,000 years ago, none of us ever were exposed to grains or beans. For one thing, grains and beans have to be cooked, but even cooking does a pretty lousy job of destroying lectins. We'll get back to this, but you can destroy lectins with a pressure cooker. The only lectin you can't destroy with a pressure cooker is gluten. It's resistant to even pressure cooking. Grains and beans were one of the two or two of the real big problems originally. then what's fascinating to me is the longer we're exposed to a plant or a plant compound, usually we can develop bugs, bacteria in our intestines and fungi in our intestines that are capable of eating these things. In fact,
questions, yeah.
Yeah, believe it or not, we have bacteria that love to eat gluten. They're really good at it. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that many people go gluten-free who probably don't necessarily need to, but when they stop eating gluten-containing foods, these bugs leave. They have nothing to eat. And so they may just be marginally sensitive to gluten, but when they eat gluten again, they don't have that line of defense against bugs. And they really notice gluten. And they go, oh, see, I told you, I'm really gluten sensitive. So the second thing that happened is 500 years ago, all of us in America are not from America. Donald Trump may think otherwise, but we are from Europe, Asia, or Africa. Even Native Americans are actually from Asia. So none of us were exposed to American plants, American lectin-containing plants, until 500 years ago when Columbian trade started. And some of our most beloved foods are some of our most mischievous, and they're American plants. And the nightshade family, for instance, is probably the most notorious, and that's potatoes, eggplant, peppers, tomatoes, goji berries. Believe it or not, goji berries are an American plant. They were called the wolfberry, and they were taken to China in trade, and they actually did very well in China, and that's why we still get most of our goji berries from China or Tibet. But so the nightshades have lectins in their peels and their seeds. And interestingly enough, Americans avoided tomatoes until the mid-18th century because they were considered part of the deadly nightshade family. And there was a gentleman whose name was Colonel Samuel Johnson, who stood on the courtyard steps in Summit, New Jersey, which is outside of Philadelphia. Most people think he was in Philadelphia when he did this. And he ate a bushel of tomatoes on the courtyard step to prove that he wouldn't die. And Michael Greger, one of my critics, uses that example to prove that I'm wrong, that a bushel of tomatoes didn't kill Colonel Johnson and hasn't killed a lot of people. But in fact, it's amazing. If you look at cultures that work with tomatoes, for instance, the Italians always peel and de-seed their tomatoes or their peppers before they use them. In fact, the chili pepper flakes and seeds that we put on our pizza were actually the discarded byproducts of getting the peels and seeds out of peppers. And they were thrown away. And now, of course, we think they're a culinary delight. The Southwest American Indians always peel and de-seed their peppers. The Hatch chili roast was just a month ago. And they do that because the peels and the seeds have the lectins. And they do that before they even grind their peppers into chili pepper in New Mexico. So there's a long history of cultures dealing with these sort of things. The other problem maker is the squash family. The squash family are also American plants. Pumpkins were coming up on Thanksgiving, the squashes. Cucumbers are actually originally from China. They're thought of as from Persia, but cucumbers didn't actually enter our general population until Columbian trade started. So they're actually a modern plant too.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're mentioning a lot of foods that most of our viewers would be like, well, gosh, I mean, a cucumber, I thought they were tomatoes, I thought they were healthy. So your argument is that it's the way that we used to prepare them, taking, you know, most of the lectins are in the seeds and the skins. And we're not doing that as often now, right, in one argument.
Right.
And then, okay, so what about the Mediterranean diet, right? I mean, everyone, you know, thinks of the Mediterranean diet as the healthiest diet. you know, they eat a lot of baba ganoush. I know these things. I just came from Israel. They eat a lot of different foods that we're talking about here as a mainstay of their diet. So,
yeah. So there's, I think the best book that was ever written, it's actually a textbook, which is unfortunate because it's never gotten the wide use that it should. There's, in fact, I'll hold it up because I happen to have it. I always have it on my desk. And it's called Food and Western Disease. And the author is from Sweden by the name of Stefan Lindeberg. And Stefan, I got turned on to him because he has studied the Ketavans or Ketavans, depending on how you like to pronounce it. And as I write about in the book, the Ketavans were a real puzzle to those of us who considered ourselves low carbers. And they have been studied extensively, but they basically have no medical care and they smoke like fiends. And they live well into their mid-90s. And there's never been a case of heart disease, never been a stroke. They don't have cancer. And so the problem is about 60% of their calories come from eating a taro root. Another 30% of their calories come from coconut. And the rest come from a smattering of fish and some fruits and vegetables. But they drive low carbers crazy because they eat an incredibly high starch diet. But back to the Mediterranean. So Stefan has looked and dissected the Mediterranean diet as other people have. And what he and others found, and I reference this in my book, is that the cereal grains and beans are actually a negative aspect of the Mediterranean diet that's countered by the polyphenols in red wine, in olive oil, in the fish that they eat, and also in the fruits and vegetables that they eat. And again, the Italians always peel their tomatoes. And in fact, I was lecturing in Istanbul last year, and I went to a sidewalk cafe and ordered a salad for lunch. And shockingly, out came these wedges of tomatoes that had been peeled and there weren't any seeds in them. And the cucumbers, which were in there, had been peeled and the core had been pulled out. So it was just a ring of the flesh of the cucumber. And I'm going, wow, you know, that's fascinating, you know, that this culture did this. And here I'm on a street corner in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. So you can actually see these things in action.
Yeah, in certain cultures. All right, let's back up again, because so in review, I mean, these lectins are, you know, can act just like gluten, open up our tight junctions, drive autoimmune. I believe there was even a chapter in your book about how it can create weight gain, weight loss resistance. I mean, maybe you should talk a little bit about that. You know, again, you know, leaky gut, yes, but maybe you want to say something else about that. But, you know, then I want people to understand, okay, great. Let's say we avoid this. How do we avoid it? Because my gosh, you just named a lot of foods. Okay, Papa's already taken a lot of foods off my plate. Now these, I'm in big trouble here, Stephen. So, but talk about the weight loss resistance connection first.
So there's certainly several factors that lectins contribute to weight gain. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is we've always assumed that beans and grains came into our diet because they were storageable compounds. And when we started farming, we had to have foods that we could eat during the winter. You know, we couldn't wander around looking for animals to eat or for leaves to eat. So most historians, including this was my major at Yale, believe the grains and beans got a toehold because we could store them.
Yeah.
Well, I went back and said, well, wait a minute, maybe, you know, maybe there's another reason why we did this. And having grown up in Omaha, Nebraska, farmland central, we know that the only way you can fatten an animal for slaughter is to feed them grains or beans or both. And that's how we do it. It's how we've always done it. So I said, well, wait a minute. If we fatten animals with grains and beans, and that's the only way we've ever found to do it, maybe grains and beans allow us to store more fat for a given amount of energy than any other food. So if you look at that research, in fact, you'll find that it's true. There is a lectin in wheat, for example, called wheat germ agglutinin. And wheat germ agglutinin is actually far more mischievous than gluten. And it's in the hull of the grain. Gluten is more in the endosperm, the seed. And so wheat germ agglutinin is this interesting little lectin that on fat cells attaches to the insulin receptor of the fat cell. Now, normally when a hormone or a message attaches to a receptor, it's like a plane docking on the jetway. And the passengers get off. In this case, the message is delivered, like insulin here, store some fat. And then the jet leaves and the gateway's open again. Well, the problem with wheat germ agglutinin, it sticks onto the receptor on a fat cell. And it just absolutely keeps pumping sugar into the fat cell and turning that sugar, turns on lipoprotein lipase and turns it into fat. But the other fascinating thing is that on a muscle cell, which has the same receptor, wheat germ agglutinin attaches to the muscle cell, but doesn't allow sugar in, but actually blocks the airplane from getting to the gate. And that's one of the theories why, for instance, marathon athletes who just live on carbohydrates, particularly wheat-based carbohydrates, are actually so skinny and actually have very little musculature. And I talk about that in the book, that marathon running is a pretty dumb idea, no offense. My wife did the 100th running of the Boston Marathon, and then I showed her the data and she hung up her spikes. Yeah. It's really dumb, but that's a whole nother subject.
I agree, but yeah, it's a whole nother show.
So that's part one, wheat germ agglutinin. Part two is getting back to leaky gut. And one of the things that's always intrigued me and many, many other people is why do we store fat that's so dangerous in our gut? Why do we have a beer belly? Why do we have a deli belly? And so we've got all these guys, we've got these foreign invaders coming through the wall of our gut. And most of your viewers know that 60, 70% of all your immune cells line the gut. They're basically our border patrol. So there's, when these guys get through, there actually is a war occurring right at the wall of the gut. Now, during a war, what you do is, in any war, you have to stockpile supplies for the troops. And where best to stockpile the supplies than at the site of the invasion. So that's why we actually store fat in our gut, because that's where the process is going. Now, the old view was, well, we have inflammation in our gut, and it's inflammation that's triggering the fat to be there. The inflammation is coming from our white blood cells attacking lectins and these LPSs that are getting through. And that's why the fat accumulates.
Are some people more, I mean, we know that there's different levels of gluten sensitivity. You said it in the beginning, right? So
yep.
Two parts to this question. Number one, are some people genetically, because of their ancestors, et cetera, more, affected by these lectins, some people less? And is it a bad thing, as you kind of said, maybe just like gluten, that we get rid of all of them? Now we stop producing all of the enzymes and our microbiome changes. So two parts to that.
Yeah. So we measure the HLA genes that associate with gluten sensitivity in all of our patients. And there are about 10% of my population that has one or more of these genes. And these guys, I absolutely say, get gluten out of your life. You're already, pre-sensitized to it. On the other hand, we have a number of people, and we measure all the autoimmune markers for celiac and everyone as well. And we have a number of people who have active celiac disease that do not carry any of these HLA markers. So it doesn't mean that just because you have celiac that you carry these genes. And conversely, though, if you carry these genes, you probably should stay away from gluten. Now, the other thing that I think is important in the book is that, you know, we've been eating these things for 10,000 years and, you know, doing a pretty good job, most of us, with it. Why have we had this sudden increase in autoimmune disease? You know, why do we have Hashimoto's thyroiditis in, you know, 30, 40 million women? Well, and that gets into what I call the seven deadly disruptors. And we won't go through all of them today, but a couple of things have really, really changed. And number one is broad spectrum antibiotic use. And we not only swallow them, we unfortunately gave them willy-nilly to any patient that walked through the door with a scratchy throat or a sniffle. And what we didn't know about broad-spectrum antibiotics was that not only do they potentially kill what you took it for, but they wipe out your entire gut flora. It's like throwing napalm or Agent Orange on a mature tropical rainforest. And people say, well, that's fine, and I'll just take some probiotics and I'll be fine. Well, unfortunately, that's like we burn a forest down and then we put some seedlings and we naively think we're going to have a mature forest in a couple of weeks. And in fact, that doesn't happen. And sadly, most of the probiotics out there are not spore-forming bacteria. And so most of our stomach acid destroys these things. So the other part of the antibiotic problem is we've been using antibiotics to feed animals for weight gain for a number of years now. And we've been naive enough to think that that was harmless, either to the animals or to us, but we know that those antibiotic residues appear in their meat. And this low-dose antibiotic, while it's not enough to get the attention of the FDA, well, it is enough, but it's enough to change our microbiome. And one of the things that they learned about fattening animals is that if you change the microbiome with antibiotics, the animal will gain weight. And lo and behold, change our microbiome with antibiotics will do the same thing, particularly if you feed us grains and beans like we do animals. So antibiotics are a big part of this mystery. The second that I think gets not enough attention is that the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, the NSAIDs, particularly ibuprofen and naproxen like Aleve and Advil, vice versa, we chew these things like candy. And I've seen a number of sports injuries that have been taking a lot of Motrin or a lot of Advil or a lot of Aleve and then develop an autoimmune disease. And this literature is well known about in the pharmaceutical company, and I show a bunch of them in the book. What we didn't as doctors know is that the damage that NSAIDs do is to the lining of the small intestine. They don't damage the stomach, which is really why NSAIDs were really popular, because aspirin damaged the stomach lining, but the NSAIDs, unlike aspirin, we couldn't see the damage because our gastroscopes and our colonoscopes couldn't get into the small intestine. And it wasn't until the pill cameras came out that we swallow that we could start seeing that, in fact, these things are literally like swallowing a hand grenade. And it's amazing to me. I mean, we have children's Advil, and we give this stuff away like candy. And the pharmaceutical companies know this. In fact, I was talking with Joseph Mercola a few weeks ago, and when he was in medical school, he's a DO, but when he was in medical school, he was a extern at a pharmacy. And he remembers distinctly that the FDA prescription Motrin had just come out, and prescription Naproxen had just come out, Naproxen. And there was a black box warning that you could not dispense over a 2 weeks supply because it was so dangerous. And, you know, he said, you know, when he was reading my book, he says, you know, that just came flooding back to me. These were prescription meds, and they carried a warning about how dangerous they were. Mm-hmm. So we've forgotten all that.
Yeah, no, it is. I stay far, far away from them. Yet many people, even healthy, concerning people, take them like it's no big deal, right? It's like, my gosh, I mean, it is a big deal. You're right. It's like a hand grenade in the intestines, for sure. What about glyphosate? Glyphosate, you know, we know that it's opening up these tight junctions, affecting the biome. And, you know, now we have a perfect storm going on.
Yeah, I mean, glyphosate is another one of these perfect storms that, you know, they convinced the FDA that glyphosate is not metabolized by humans, which is true. But they didn't mention to anybody that the shikimate pathway is used by bacteria. And so our gut microbiome is actually pretty well killed off by glyphosate. The other thing that nobody realized was that glyphosate was going to appear in conventional crops. There, you know, originally it was developed just as a weed killer for GMOs. But now we use glyphosate to actually make crops die, conventional crops, so that you can harvest corn and you can harvest wheat and you can harvest soybeans and you can harvest flax. And we don't wash the stuff off. We then feed it to our animals, or we grind it up into our consumer products. Yeah. So 24 hours a day, we're consuming this stuff. In fact, you probably saw recently that most California wines are loaded with glyphosate. Yeah. And even some of the organic wines. And that's because, in fact, I was just on the phone with a Texas farmer about this yesterday. They use glyphosate between the rows of vines, and also in Texas between the rows of plants to kill the weeds. And it obviously gets into the grapes and it gets into the plant. So the really scary thing that we were talking about yesterday was that, as you know, Monsanto is now being purchased by Bayer.
Yeah.
And Bayer has been trying, Monsanto's been trying for years to get into the European Union, and they've been pretty successful in blocking them. But now that Bayer owns Monsanto, Bayer pulls the strings in Europe. And I think it's only a matter of time before we see glyphosate in Europe, which will be a disaster.
What a disappointment, because the wine, of course, it's outlawed. They're not using glyphosate. And the other thing is the way that obviously they do the crops in Napa. It's not dry farms, so they're irrigating. And then the glyphosate, as you said, it's sprayed here. It ends up in the water, even in organic.
It's in the water. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's horrible. But yeah, so I mean, you put these three things together. I mean, and no doubt it's the perfect storm, which makes these lectins that are actual toxins to protect the plant now even more toxic to us as humans, driving inflammation, driving autoimmune, as you pointed out, even weight, you know, loss or weight gain and weight loss resistance. So, you know, this is a big problem. Okay. So one more question I want to give. Okay, what can we do to, you know, you have a 90-day program in your book, which is great, because people are going to go, you know, okay, how do I get rid of these things? You know, I need, and let me do it for 90 days. Let's see how I feel. And I would challenge that you do that, right? But okay, Norman Borlaug, right? He did some hybridization in plants, right? And, you know, Bill Davis, that was his big thing, is that, you know, it's what we did that made these different strains of glutens, aka lectins. So how does that play into this? Did we hybridize things to make it even more toxic? Or is that really not a factor in your mind?
Yeah, I don't think that's a factor in my mind. In fact, you know, ancient grains are just as mischievous as modern grains. For instance, the famous Iceman of the northern Italian Alps, who was frozen and perfectly preserved 5,000 years ago. He's riddled with arthritis. And in the pockets of his cape are both Einhorn and Kamut varieties of wheat, so ancient grains. And unfortunately, you see that these grains are just as mischievous as our modern wheat. I think that's a bit of a, it's a great story, but I think we have far better reasons, like antibiotics, like Advil and Aleve, and like glyphosate, that have really tipped things over. I don't think it was the wheat variety.
Yeah, there's three things you pinpoint for sure. So, okay, all right, let's talk about, hey, I want to see if this makes me feel better. Talk a little bit about your 90-day plan, because right now I'm confused. Here's what people are going to say, right? I don't know what to eat. So when people say those words, they eat whatever they eat usually.
Right.
You know this. So tell them how to do this in 90 days.
So the most important rule, and I wish it wasn't true, but it's not what I tell you to eat that's important. It's what I tell you not to eat. And that I see over and over again. I was taught this when I was a fellow at Great Ormond Street in London, England, by a gastroenterologist. And, you know, I thought he was kind of crazy, but looking back, he was really smart. And for instance, our sisters at Great Ormond Street, where I did children's heart surgery, after an operation, they'd send the mother to the corner little store and have them bring two cups of fresh yogurt to feed their babies. And, you know, smart American like me said, well, what a stupid idea to do. And they say, oh no, you know, doctor, you've killed off all my baby's bugs and I must put new bugs in. And we go, yeah, sure. But you know, this is real. So back to the question. Eat what I like people to eat like it's 9,999 years ago, and just before the advent of modern agriculture. We ate a lot of tubers. There are plenty of tubers besides potatoes. We didn't eat potatoes because they're an American plant. So have some sweet potatoes, have some cassava, have some yucca, have some taro root, have jicama. We're designed to eat lots of leaves. So all the leaves you want. Have, you know, one of my favorite sayings is the only purpose of food is to get olive oil into your mouth. And getting back to the Mediterranean diet, there are cultures, particularly in Crete, in Sardinia, and in Spain, that use a liter of olive oil per week. And one of my favorite studies that I always bring up, the study was just finished about 2 years ago. They took 65-year-old people in Spain, and they divided them into three groups. All had to eat a Mediterranean diet. The first group had to have a liter of olive oil per week, and they actually had to bring their empty liter back to the clinic, pick up the new one, so they knew that that's what they were doing. The second group had to have the equivalent calories in raw walnuts. And the third group ate a low-fat Mediterranean diet. And they followed these people for 5 years. And the original part of the study was to look at memory. The walnut and the olive oil group had preserved memory at the end of 5 years. In fact, the olive oil group had slightly increased memory. The low-fat group had deteriorated memory. They then looked at breast cancer. And the women in the olive oil group had a 67% less incidence of breast cancer than either of the other groups. They then looked at heart disease, and lo and behold, the walnut and the olive oil group had diminished episodes of heart disease compared to the low-fat Mediterranean diet. And finally, I think the most interesting thing is the walnut and the olive oil group lost weight during the 5 years, and the low-fat group gained weight. So people say, a liter of olive oil, that's 12 to 14 tablespoons of olive oil a day, I'm going to gain weight. In fact, we know that fat does not make you fat, particularly right, if you don't eat it with carbohydrates. That's fat and carbohydrates is a great recipe for disaster. So the other thing that I go into the book, and again, having grown up in Omaha and Milwaukee, it makes me sad to say this, but animal protein in two large international studies has been shown to be equal to sugar consumption in causing obesity and diabetes, equal. And that's because this is something that Dr. Adkins unfortunately didn't know, is that we, as you know, have no storage system for protein unless we're building muscle, but right. we don't waste energy. So we convert protein into sugar, gluconeogenesis.
Right.
And one of the problems with our high protein diet in America is the protein is the last to be digested of the various things we eat. And so we've already met all of our glucose needs of all of our cells by the time protein is available. And so protein is basically automatically converted into glucose and then stored as fat.
Right.
And this is actually why Dr. Adkins died a fat man. My first book was bought by Random House, and my editor had done all the Adkins diets, all the South Beach diets. And so I got to know Dr. Adkins' ghostwriter and pick her brain. And then I got to know his head nurse. And actually, she's still my patient today. She's in her 90s now. But this is what Adkins didn't know. He was originally a high fat doctor, but he got into so much trouble with the American Medical Association that he morphed into a high protein diet. And that's actually his unfortunate big mistake. And he died a fat man. It's actually very true. His nurse confirms it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Okay. So, hey, avoidance. I mean, that's what does your 90-day program do?
So, yeah, what we do is we have a 3-day kickstart program where people get addicted to this smoothie. There's a wonderful woman from Santa Barbara who did the recipes, Irina, and she has a website called Catalyst Cuisine, and she'll make meals and ship them all across the country, FedEx, cheap. So she can actually do the whole program, but all of the recipes for the 3 days are in there. They're easy to do. I like people to make a green smoothie out of some romaine lettuce and some spinach and half an avocado and some mint and some lemon juice. And it's really addicting. And my wife has it every day of her life. She can't get off of it. But the reason we did that is there's really good evidence that you can completely change your microbiome in about 3 days. And there's also compelling evidence that if you stray back into the way you're eating, within 3 more days, your microbiome will return to its former bad state. So what I like to do is really kind of kickstart cleaning up the bugs in our gut and then start having people really avoid all the grains, the pseudo grains. Corn is a mischief maker. Avoid the plants from North America that you think are good for you. The other thing that's important to realize is most of the vegetables that people eat in the United States are not vegetables at all. They're fruits. And one of the things we've forgotten is that up until about 50 years ago, we only had fruit once a year during fruit season in the summer and early fall.
Absolutely.
And there was no fruit. And we, like great apes, use fruit to gain weight for the winter when there's less food, whether it was a dry season, rainy season, or a cold season. All great apes only gain weight during fruit season. And it's one of the things I go into in my first book. So tomatoes are a fruit, a cucumber is a fruit, a pepper is a fruit, a squash is a fruit, a pumpkin's a fruit. And we really have to be wary that we take fructose and convert it into triglycerides to store as fat. So we really eliminate fruit. We say, give fruit the boot. Sorry about that. And if you're gonna eat fruit locally in season. A piece of fruit coming from Chile in February is not natural. There's no such thing as, you know, blueberries in February.
Yeah.
So that's what we do. We like people to really increase their olive oil. If they don't have ApoE4, we like them to use coconut oil, avocado oil. Avocados are great. Eat an avocado a day. But again, the only purpose of food is to get olive oil into your mouth. I actually pour olive oil on my avocado.
I do too.
I really do. And so we also have a program for what I call my intensive care program, which is a ketogenic version of my program. And so if you're a diabetic, if you have cancer, if you have signs of dementia, if you have kidney failure, there's an entire chapter for you where I get even meaner and nastier. But I want people to eat about an 80% fat diet if you have those conditions. And it really does turn things around quite dramatically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're keto, pro-keto. I mean, the diet obviously works so well with ketosis. It's when you're eating moderate protein, high fat. It's, you kind of start eliminating lectins like crazy.
So yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah, so those watching, because we have a lot of keto people, it's like, yeah, ketosis is probably the easiest way to, you know, to avoid lectins, no doubt about it. Well, Meredith, I know you have some questions. I had so many, but I think it's a fascinating topic because not a lot of people are speaking this.
It sure is. And something interesting for me that came up when I was reading the book as well was a testimonial of a woman who had been following your program and getting a lot of great results in general, but still had some persistent eczema on her eyelids. And you kind of really did some detective work with her diet and realized that she was eating chicken that was organic, but this chicken was still eating, you know, possibly soybeans and corn and some feed that wasn't natural to that that animal's diet. So can you speak to a little bit about what we eat and how important that is?
Yeah, we are what we eat, but we are what the thing we're eating ate. And a number of years ago, there were a couple of little articles in the alternative medicine literature that said that if an animal is eating lectins that it isn't used to eating, that those lectins will appear in its flesh. And I kind of said, oh man, that's really out there. But I didn't discount it. And then this particular woman, I now have a number of them, that she is a psychologist in Los Angeles who had pretty bad lupus, was on 2 drug therapy, and realized that that probably wasn't a very good idea for the rest of her life. And we got her off of her drugs. And she had some pretty bad skin lesions from lupus. And she completely cleared except for a little bit of eczema on her upper eyelids. And so we're going through the list. And she was avoiding the no list, you know, like a saint. And so I'm going through the good food list. And I said, and I get to chicken. I said, now you're eating pastured chicken, chickens that, you know, go out and eat bugs. And she said, oh, yeah, I eat free range organic. You know, that's my favorite food. And I went, wait a minute, that's, you know, free range is kept in a warehouse and along with 10,000 other chickens, and they're fed corn and soybeans, even if they're organic corn and soybeans. So I said, I tell you what, stop the chicken. And I said, call me back. And a month later, she says, eczema's gone. That was it. And so it was this organic free range chicken. And since her, that's been about 5 years. I have a number of particularly women who it's their organic free range chicken that's their culprit in their autoimmune disease. There's another gentleman in the book who is actually from St. Louis who travels a lot, and his autoimmune disease and his irritable bowel went away, but he noticed that when he was traveling, things would kick up, even though he was really being religious. And I said, well, you know, what are you eating? He says, well, there's only 2 things I'll eat when I'm traveling of meats. It'll be shrimp and it'll be chicken. And so I said, ooh, you know, most of the shrimp in a restaurant comes from Vietnam or Thailand. and it's fed grains. Yeah. And I can guarantee you, you're not getting a pasture chicken in the restaurant. I said, just, you know, he thought he was getting gluten kind of dusted on it, and that's why he was reacting. So I said, just humor me. Don't eat that stuff. And just have salads and vegetables, and you'll be all right. You'll survive. And sure enough, those were the two factors that had kicked him over. So I think our food supply has changed so much. And, you know, whether it's the antibiotics in our food, whether the fact that a chicken, which is an insectivore, is being fed corn and soybeans, which is never designed to eat, whether, you know, our cows, which are grass eaters and alfalfa eaters, are now being fed corn and soybeans. You know, like I talk about, cows get such heartburn from the lectin in corn irritating their esophagus that they actually stop eating. And half the world's production of calcium carbonate, TUMS, is mixed into cattle food, so they'll keep eating. Wow. Yeah, it's just, you know, if this is getting a cow's attention, maybe we should pay attention.
That's so true. So, and I'm wondering too, though, so there's a lot of things we can do to mitigate some of the effects, and oh, there goes that echoing again, which, you know, we're peeling, we're de-seeding, we're avoiding some of the major offenders. But is there, you know, for some of us who maybe just want to treat ourselves to those lectins, is there maybe a supplement or some kind of gut support that we could take to mitigate some of the damage?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I have a product called Lectin Shield, and it has seven different ingredients that absorb lectins, and it actually works pretty well. Now, the problem is it's not a license to cheat. Some people view it as that, but if I know I'm going to a friend's house or a dinner party, and I know that I'm not going to be able to avoid the things I should avoid, then, you know, I'll pop a couple when I'm traveling in Europe. I carry several jars, and I put some videos on my YouTube channel to kind of before and after what my belly looks like when I'm unfortunately dabbling in their pasta and bread with and without Lectin Shield, and it's pretty funny. So yeah, so you can, you know, you can take these, and there are other supplements that work. You know, I'd love you to go to GundryMD and buy my supplements. But in the book, if I tell you, here's a great supplement, I not only tell you my supplement, but I tell you the dosage of the supplement, and you can go to Costco, or you can go to Vitacost, or you can go to Amazon. And the point is, some of my critics say the book is to sell supplements. Well, the supplements are way at the end of the book, and supplements are supplements. They supplement what you're doing the rest of the time with what goes through your mouth. And I've had so many people that say, all I got to do is take 20 supplements and I can get away with murder. And I got news for you. You can't. I see it over and over and over again.
That's so true. And I'm just curious, kind of as a final question, what's a day in the life look like for you with the diet? Are you having three meals a day? Are you doing intermittent fasting? What are you consuming?
Well, I wrote about this in the book. From January through June, every year for the last 10 years, during the week, I eat one meal a day. I fast 22 out of 24 hours. I eat my meal is between 6 and 8 o'clock at night, because quite frankly, that's when I'm home with my wife. If I had it to do perfectly, I'd probably have that meal between 12 and 2 in the afternoon, but that's impractical. And so on the weekends, I'll have two meals a day. I do agree with Joseph Mercola that I think you need to break ketosis probably once a week.
I taught him that, by the way.
Good, yeah. And it's funny because I've been doing that for years, and you know, Joe Mercola, he'll take things to an extreme, and good for him. Somebody yeah. needs to do this, but also good for him. He'll say, "Oops, you know, I was wrong about this."
Yeah.
And some people just don't get it that you can be wrong in researching. I was wrong in a lot of things I said in my first book.
And I love that about Joe. You're right. I mean, he'll just be like, okay, yeah, there's a better way he does it. I, you know, we were walking on a walk in Florida when we had that conversation, And, you know, he was asking me about things. He's like, I think you're right. I'm going to try it, you know. And I helped write, I think it was chapter 10 in his book based on diet variation, even seasonal variation, you know, is huge. And people don't do it. It has a massive impact on our microbiome. So sounds like, you know, you're right in line with us on that, as a matter of fact. So,
yeah. So, I mean, for instance, this weekend, I didn't have breakfast and I didn't have lunch the entire weekend. I didn't have breakfast this morning. I don't eat breakfast. You know, breakfast is the stupidest meal of the day. You know, it's like, do you really think we crawled out of our cave and said, what's for breakfast? I mean, we had to find breakfast. There was no storage system. And if we didn't find breakfast till dinner, that was breakfast. That was break fast. You know, the French actually have no word for breakfast. Déjeuner was first meal and it was lunch, and they had to invent petit déjeuner.
Yeah, it's an American thing, actually. The Italian culture doesn't eat breakfast either. It's like,
no.
Yeah.
No, they have an espresso and go.
Yeah, exactly. Done.
So, for tonight, I'm actually going to go home. We're going to have a huge mixing bowl of salad with a couple avocados in it, some radicchio, some Belgian endive, some arugula. I try to get cruciferous vegetables in me daily, if not eating them with supplements. So usually during the week, we tend to eat fairly close to a vegan diet. And then on the weekends, we will tend to have wild fish or wild shellfish. I call myself a veg aquarian. I eat mostly vegetables and throw in a few seafood.
Sorry about that. The dogs, you know.
That's right. I have four dogs, so I understand.
You know, one of the things that was the last question. We're over time. You're an interesting guy. You know, you do a lot of the same things we do. You know, it's when you're eating one or two meals a day, you know, we would agree that most disease is the abundance, right? It's eating too much protein, too much carbohydrate, you know, and it's so much easier not to fall into that when you're eating one meal. I mean, to eat too much of anything becomes, you know, much harder when you're eating one meal. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, and I agree with Jason Fung, who I've gotten to know. And, you know, in a way, he's right that it's easier not to eat at all. And so, you know, once you stop eating, it frees up a whole lot of time.
Oh, my God.
And so I do not disagree with him.
So we train our doctors on fasting. I mean, fasting, we couldn't get, you know, the different conditions well, our docs, if we didn't utilize fasting, that's for sure. So,
right. Well,
thank you so much, Stephen. We appreciate you being on. It's great, great information.
Well, thanks for having me on. We'll keep spreading the word.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Pompa. Thank you, Dr. Gundry, for all that you're doing, for getting this information out. And one last time, if you guys want to check out his book, you can go to drgundry.com and gundrymd.com and check out more of Dr. Gundry's work. So thanks so much, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Have a fantastic weekend, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Great. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.